Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. I'm your host, Pierce Redman, and you can find this podcast and all of my other podcasts on porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. Well, today we are joined once again by Aaron Franz from theageoftransitions.com. Aaron is joining us today to talk about his excellent book, Revolve, Man's Scientific Rise to Godhood, which dives into transhumanism and its relationship between alchemy and the occult and a whole range of subjects that we'll hopefully get into today. Well, Aaron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here, Pierce. I really appreciate it, and I'm excited to talk to you today.
Well, yeah, as I said in our email, since I finished this book, I have been just dying to talk about it with somebody, and it's a little difficult to broach the subject of the alchemical sciences and transhumanism with the average person, but hopefully we'll be able to do that today. But before we get started, I think it's a good idea just to refresh the listeners a little bit about the sort of key ideas and terms that we're going to be discussing. So if we could just very briefly outline what is transhumanism or the transhumanist movement and the singularity which they're all sort of striving to attain.
Yes. Well, transhumanism is the idea, it's a philosophy that the ideal in the philosophy is that we should take emerging technologies, some of which are beginning to be developed, some of which have yet to be fully flower and develop fully, things like artificial intelligence, nanotech, life extension, even biotechnology, cloning, all these sort of things. We should take these sciences to their fullest in order that we can use these technologies to alter the evolution of humanity. So human beings take evolution into their own hands through science. They begin genetically engineering themselves, enhancing themselves with chips that they put in their brain to enhance the cognitive function of the brain, merging with artificial intelligence machines, that sort of idea. And the singularity ties right in with it. It's hard to distinguish the two. But singularity specifically is about artificial intelligence, has to do with artificial general intelligence being a machine that is able to think and learn and grow on its own. So it's able to learn, and then it can expand its own intelligence through machine learning. And the idea, the theory behind the singularity is that machines will be so good at doing this once they get artificial general intelligence actually up and going, they're going to be so good that they're going to expand to such a level of intelligence that they're going to far surpass humans, and then they're going to bring on this wave of technological change, and the world will change. The whole entire world will be changed incredibly rapidly, and everything just gets crazy.
Yes, and this seems to be being pushed by the techno-progressives, which is a term that you use a lot in the book, and they seem to view everything that about transhumanism is wonderful and amazing, and they also seem to view all of life's woes, including emotions and humanity, as somehow inherently evil. And their old, you know, end goal is paradise engineering to sort of make everyone happy. And, you know, you talk about how this feeds into the whole eugenics movement and how the transhumanists have sort of taken on the mantle of eugenics in modern times right now. Obviously, eugenics is not a fun word to use anymore. And that they would create this wonderful technocratic world government, possibly, you know, ruled by a super intelligent computer, which is a quite startling and scary sort of a notion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to lighten up the conversation, we were talking about paradise engineering. I would say that probably the best ever representation of that idea and like sort of how it could go all wrong was Ren and Stimpy, where I forget what the episode was called, but it's where Stimpy makes the happy helmet for Ren, and
yes,
he's like, Stimpy, Ren is sad. And he puts the helmet on and it makes, yes, him happy. He sings the happy, happy, joy, joy song, mm-hmm, and eventually Ren has to hit himself in the head with a hammer. That's like, that's literally the idea of paradise engineering, is that, you know, all bad emotion and all pain and suffering of any kind is just blanket on its face bad, therefore we should get rid of it, make the happy helmet, and then we'll be happy forever.
Yeah, and everything will be great, you know, no problems anymore. And and within that, they also seem to want to create this super logical society where, you know, people would be sort of programmed at birth to fulfill a particular function, be it, you know, a worker or a scientist or something like that. And that on its face can seem very foreign and strange and almost, you know, so science fiction like that people will kind of dismiss that. But you take a lot of time in the book to really go into the fact that this idea of the perfect logical society has really existed for centuries. And you detail this in, you know, tremendously in the chapter in your book called Logic and Reason. And you go into the notion of the great work and how for centuries there have been various different sort of secret societies, the illuminated ones and other things like that, which have been working towards the notion of the logical society. And perhaps we could get into that with Francis Bacon, who is featured prominently in your book, and his story of the New Atlantis.
Yes. Yeah, very important piece of literature. If anybody hasn't read that, they need to. it's a cornerstone of what our Western civilization has come to become in our day. It's one of those works that you can actually call prophetic, and in every sense, it really is. Now, prophecy itself, I have, you know, my own kind of particular view on prophecy. That's not sort of typical, I guess. Being that prophecy, a person can be a prophet if they have information that most people don't. You know, I mean, if there is some sort of agenda that is to be carried out over a period of not just decades, not even just centuries, but perhaps even millennia, if there are groups that do exist that have long-range plans, and I believe that there are, if they were at all effective in carrying out these plans, then they would be able to tell you, you know, what's coming, because, you know, it's part of their plan. It's like, well, we want to do this, so we'll tell you ahead of time. It's going to happen. So that's how prophecy works. And there's a lot of nuance and stuff to add on to what I just said there to sort of flesh it out. But just that alone is important to remember when you're reading Bacon, the New Atlantis, and Bacon himself. there's so many little alleys I can go in, because even Bacon, I feel like he's obviously a person who is tied to the world of the occult, to the world of secret societies. He's said to be, what was it? I forget exactly. He was like the head of either Freemasonry or Rosicrucianism, both. Yeah. I can't remember the specifics of that, but I mean, that's all part of the history of him, his biography. Expanding that even further, because why not? I just want to expand it the way here because I feel like doing this. Francis Bacon, I think, is a composite character of – he wasn't just one person, one historical personage. He was, in fact, a group of people that was later written into history as one person. So you had the labors of a group of people, which when taken together is a tremendous amount and has tremendous impact. Well, if you take that tremendous amount of work and the tremendous impact that it has, and you focus it onto one persona, one focal point, one figure that people can study in history books, then it makes it more palatable, digestible for the average person to take on those ideas that are part of that work that the group is doing. So for that work to be effective and for it to be, again, digested by people later who come along later and read history books, it's easier if they just have one figure. You know, your George Washington, your Francis Bacon, your William Shakespeare's. I'm not saying George Washington is one of these, but certainly Francis Bacon, I think so. William Shakespeare, absolutely. It's funny that William Shakespeare, it's said, is actually Francis Bacon, but then you take it a little further, then, well, who's Francis Bacon? It's the same thing. You know what I mean? So it's all just a big secret society project. Is that's my thoughts on it. And I have read quite a bit of material to give me this opinion. I'm not just coming up with it out of nowhere. It's not just my opinion on my own. I've read stuff that said to this effect.
And when you look at Francis Bacon, I mean, it's all how could one man really do? Obviously, there are super intelligent people who accomplish a lot, but what is attributed to Francis Bacon is truly shattering. The amount from science to literature.
Yep.
You know, he is at least according to legend, funded some of the original U.S. colonists that came to the Americas. And that sort of leads us back into, again, this the idea of his the New Atlantis, which is this utopian story about a technocratic utopia that is ruled by this elite secret society of scientists. And maybe you could expand a little bit upon that, because I think it does really have a very stark connection to the transhumanist movement itself.
Yes. Yeah, there's definitely – okay, so he lays out – mythical land that is explored by a secret society, and when they get there, it's this place that nobody knows about, but it's like this sort of like utopian civilization, this little gem that is run in a very occult fashion. Like all of the rules of the of their land are very bizarre, and they would seem strict to most people, but they do tie back to sort of a lot of occult and secret society ideas with the way that the families are run and all the different rituals that they have to go through. And I forget, there's this one like dinner scene. I forget exactly how it goes. I wish I would have looked at my notes, but there's so many like little details like that, that if you've read about secret societies, you go, oh, okay, it's describing a ritual initiation here. It's describing, certain very specific rites, which secret societies do hold. And, they have their reasons for doing that. It's very clear when you know about the subject that that's what's going on. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, they're describing all these technologies that exist there. And the technologies are sorts of things that only exist today, really, like submarines, and they describe like amplifiers for music and things like that, and like perfumes and all sorts of crazy stuff. I forget all the details.
Yeah, even like sort of television type stuff is alluded to, and of course, Bacon being part of the, he was a Rosicrucian and a Freemason, and just sort of general. Secret society work at that point was the idea of sort of expanding human consciousness and understanding so that, this elite group could sort of lead the profane masses, and that this would be done through the use of science as well as through the use of the occult. And, that they would be able to destroy the old world order and create this new one, the new world. And particularly talking about expanding human consciousness, this is something that we see time and time again in the transhumanist movement.
Yes.
Ray Kurzweil talks a lot about this, and you describe some wild, wild things. He talks about expanding human consciousness to the point where we could harness the power of the cosmos and.
Yeah.
Answer all of life's questions, and you also something that I really appreciated was that you went into the Bavarian Illuminati, which is something that a lot of people kind of shy away from when you use that term.
Yeah.
But they were also very much part of this, and this whole the idea of the Illuminated Ones, and that they would be able to enlighten the world, and. Yeah. All of those things, the secret societies, the idea of the great work and transhumanism, they all have one thing in common, and that is their adherence to alchemy. And perhaps with that, we could dive deep into the relationship between transhumanism and alchemy.
Yes. Well, alchemy is a very important subject to study, and if you're studying the cult, it'll pop up pretty quickly because it's really... how do you say it's sort of the philosophy science of the occult tradition, certainly the Western occult traditions. That's what alchemy is. And you know, you explain it as such, and it has a lot to do with consciousness and expanding consciousness, as you're saying. That's really what a lot of the symbolism has always been about. But at the same time, it's a holistic approach to existence in that it doesn't separate science from religion from philosophy, but it kind of uses all three to study what it is to be human and study what it means to be intelligent and try to, you know, enhance those things. And it's funny, the transhumanist movement is always talking about expanding consciousness, and they're doing it in such a way that again, there's so many levels here. I would say that the promotion of transhumanism as it is now is one that would lead one to believe that it's a completely scientific idea. So you've got this idea, again, you've got the creationists versus the scientists in today's world, where, you know, the whole question of the genesis of man, well, is there a God? Is creationism real? Or is it that, you know, it's everything's matter and we just came from nothing? And, you know, the nihilistic view there. And that's kind of, you know, you got the two camps. Well, beyond that, there's a greater understanding that exists beyond that. I'd say that people who know what they're doing in the occult understand that, and that's what they do right, actually. However, at the same time, you get these ideas like transhumanism promoting expansion of consciousness, which is a part of alchemy. However, they're doing it in such a way so that it panders and caters to people that are on the nihilistic, materialistic, atheist, scientist sort of spectrum that we see now. So I would say a closed-minded view of the world. They're the people who promote transhumanism and just other people that promote similar ideas are doing that. And again, you can ask, well, are they doing that out of necessity, or are they doing it knowingly to manipulate people? I think it's a little bit of both, but but without a doubt, there is something way beyond just the shallow scientific view of what we have this idea of transhumanism. There's something that goes far beyond that, without a doubt.
Yeah, and also, I mean, as much as the transhumanists might sort of play to the atheist scientist crowd, ultimately their goal is to attain godhood.
Yes.
And they openly speak about this.
Yep.
This is not something that they necessarily hide, you know.
Yep.
And then again, this relates so strongly with the goals of alchemists and of all of these, you know, various secret societies, which was to attain godhood.
Yep.
And the transhumanists will do this, you know, by however possible. And it's just, it's so startling that they, you know, I found in the book a lot this sort of back and forth with the transhuman, you know, at least the sort of upper echelon of people who are really the movers and shakers in the movement, you know, that they will sort of play to one group, but at the same time, they don't necessarily hide their true intentions. And I think a lot of people are sort of very easily swayed. They sort of like what they, you know, they take the parts that they like, and they sort of, yeah, well, whatever, maybe, you know, maybe they do want to become gods, but that's you know, I'm going to have my life extension and all these other things.
Well, exactly. They're being subversive in what they're doing to get to their occult goal of being God. And the people, again, who are alchemists within transhumanism, who are the movers and shakers, and even people behind the scenes who are movers and shakers in this whole project, that's what they're after. They're after the godhood thing. And, you know, they'll, whatever anybody else wants to believe, whatever, you know, they're closed-minded fools, and, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's just, again, when you're dealing with ideas and ideals and trying to promote ideas, what you want to do is to be as loud with the idea as you possibly can. You don't want to be as loud with your specific personality. It's not like I am Stanley Johnson and I am for transhumanism and you need to know who I am. I guess you could say this of Ray Kurzweil. Let's just say, hey, I am Ray Kurzweil and this is the singularity and we need to make this happen. See, in the occult tradition, Ray Kurzweil is standing on a place that they call Fool's Mountain. Fool's Mountain is for the egoist. It's you know, like an actor wants to be known and loves people loving them. That's sort of, it's, you know, pandering to the ego. Whereas the one who is seen as being virtuous, it's all about the idea. So, okay, you have this idea of becoming God and, you know, raising the consciousness of all of humanity. You don't need to promote yourself in doing that. You need to promote the idea and get it as many other people in the world thinking about that and seeing it as a possibility and making it happen. So it's the whole mind over matter principle, is you have to make the idea seem possible first. That is the first and foremost thing. If we're talking about alchemy and the process of alchemy and the really basic process of how it works, it's the promotion of ideas and possibilities. And if people believe in an idea and they believe it's possible, then they are able to make it happen. It's and that's really true, actually.
It strikes me too in the book is that obviously the alchemical sciences, this has been going on for centuries, probably even much, you know, even before that. You talk about the Egyptians and all sorts of different societies that were doing this, but we do start to see it kind of, in my opinion, at least, really starting to materialize in a real way, that these ideas have sort of broken through, you know, popular culture and popular consciousness to a point right now where it does seem as if this really could happen, especially if you listen to people like Kurzweil or some of the other big transhumanists. You know, they're talking about it not at, well, when, you know, if it happens, but when it happens.
Yeah.
And I found that another very powerful aspect of this and how powerful the practice of alchemy has been.
Yeah, it could happen in a literal sense. That is to say, humans becoming gods. You know, I mean, humans becoming gods, human becoming, extending their life to a point where they can live indefinitely. So, you know, the conquering death. These are alchemical ideas as the elixir of life, of finding eternal life. But the whole transhumanist approach to this is a completely concrete, literal approach to alchemy, which is not completely concrete. It does come back to the physical world. However, it is spiritual. It gets wrapped up in the spiritual world and the ideal and sort of the idea that, you know, Plato talked about how the real world is the spiritual world of ideas and that is to be exalted above the material. If we're talking about the transhumanist movement as it is today, it is on the material, literal end of alchemy. So any sort of signs and symbols you see in alchemy, it wouldn't just be allegorical and meaning sort of the spiritual thing or a philosophical concept. To a transhumanist, they would want to see that made into something real. For example, the concept of the androgyne, where you take male and female and you combine them into a single personality. Well, the old spiritual version of that in alchemy is that you do that within yourself. It's a thing in your psyche, a thing in your spirit, and it's about the male and female regenerative principles that are not necessarily physical. However, they come to affect the physical world. Well, the transhumanists see these symbols, which can be interpreted philosophically, spiritually, and they say, oh, okay, we need to create androgynous post-human supermen who live forever and are gods. And that's what they want to do.
And yeah, the whole androgyny element within transhumanism is very, very... I mean, I would say kind of disturbing in the direction that they're really taking this. And perhaps we can get a little bit into that, because that is a very important part of alchemy, is the sort of androgynous godlike figure. And we see in the transhumanist movement this the whole sort of notion that gender is yet again one of these other little annoying parts of life that separate us and is evil. And you go into many of these, a lot of different radical feminists that talked about eliminating sexual distinction as a way to sort of free everyone. And I don't know if you're familiar with her, but Valerie Solanas was an artist and a writer, and she wrote the Scum Manifesto, and later tried to assassinate Andy Warhol. But in the Scum Manifesto, which stands for Society for Cutting Off Men, she talked about creating a whole new sort of like female-only socialist society, but a major part of that would be the complete automation of the entire world, which is another thing that we see time and time again in the transhumanist movement, this idea of automating everything.
Yes, with every extremist little cult that we see pop up, and they are all interrelated, these things like the radical feminism that you're talking about, an extremist cult, no doubt, and extremist transhumanists, they all tend towards this sort of materialistic scientific utopian ideal where, yes, everything's automated, we have these machines, and then you get the idea of, you know, if we're biologically enhanced or whatever, then, you know, we don't need our sexual distinction anymore. So, you know, obviously from we may have been male and female all this time for millennia up until now, but that doesn't mean anything anymore because now we've surpassed that, we've become gods, and all those silly creatures who lived for untold eons before us, well, we'll just throw that all in the garbage. Their lives never meant anything anyway. They were all stupid, they were idiots, they were, you know, what were they even doing? Why they even, they only existed as a stepping stone to this moment that we've attained through intellect again, and they think they're being logical and rational in doing this, and when they are in fact deluded, they're extremist wackos. But you see so much of this, and the transhumanists themselves have written about this in that paper that I cite in the postgenderism chapter. They wrote a postgenderism paper, James Hughes and George Dvorsky, a couple of pretty prominent transhumanists with the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. They wrote extensively about this, and they said they cited the radical feminists. They were like, "Yeah, these people were talking about this," and they cited other people with similar ideas and how they go about saying how, you know, yeah, gender doesn't really mean anything. We can go beyond it. You know, why wouldn't we? And so they write quite a bit about it.
Yeah. Oh, and that's always, why not? I mean, you know, that's okay, right? We can just keep going there.
No problem.
Well, now that sticking along those same lines, I wanted to ask you, how do you see the current trends in the transgender movement, at least as they exist in the United States today, because we see that transgender people have come a long way in gaining recognition and things like that. And I was sort of torn between, you know, is this sort of being pushed as a stepping stone to the post-gender society, or are the transhumanists kind of co-opting this group and, you know, talking about how wonderful it is and how this is such a good thing when in reality they actually want to implement this on a large scale?
I think they are being co-opted and they don't have the first clue. Transgender people have an agenda to get equality for themselves, and because of that, they are easily manipulated by others. But beyond that, okay, this is a very sensitive issue. And I want to say this right, because it's not that I have distaste for what they're doing or like are against them in any way. It's the greater context that I'm always interested in. And again, I think that they are being co-opted. And as what they're doing is they are in the very beginning stages of gaining acceptance for what they are, and their whole mission is actually a very infantile mission. I'm not saying that as a criticism of them. I'm saying that more as a criticism of everybody, of all of us, in that we're so emotionally reactive to new ideas that they have to be introduced in the most silly sort of childish sort of way, like, oh, you, love is good and people love each other, and don't you know somebody you love? And if you do, then you should be loving of this. And I don't know if this is coming out properly, but I feel the need to explain this properly. It's pandering to the lowest common denominator, which it has to do, because sadly, that's how you start something going. However, beyond that, what is the greater context? The greater context is, well, the transhumanist thing is around the corner. Transgender folks, for the most part, may not be even too familiar with the idea, or let alone do they care, because they have their own thing to worry about, and they've got a lot on their plate to deal with there, and they're dealing in such shallow water with the rest of us, mind you. We're all dealing in such shallow water, like, oh, are we loving or are we not loving? Yeah. And that's all of us. We're in this shallow little pool that is on the coast of a giant ocean. So we're here in a little vacation getaway that has this tiny little, like, 3-foot deep pool for kids. We're all swimming in it. There's not enough room for us. Meanwhile, there's a giant ocean out there, being that this huge wave of change that is coming no matter what. We don't see it because we're all too shallow, and we're swimming in this little shallow end. And let alone, there's this whole bigger issue that everything ties into. I would say that the transgender movement is it tends to push towards the whole transhumanist movement. It could be used as a stepping stone, because I don't know. And it just
no, and it's a difficult subject to broach, because, you know, instantly if you question anything about it, you're seen as somehow against it.
Yes, and, exactly.
You know,
exactly. That's part of the shallow pool we're in. Yes. I'm trying to talk about.
Yeah. And you should be able to talk about something like that critically. You shouldn't have to just accept everything as, oh, well, this is progress, this is good. Mm-hmm. You should always look behind that, especially when we see prominent transhumanists talking about transgender people. We have prominent. I believe it's the person behind Sirius Radio
is Martine Rothblatt.
Yes, yeah. Which is a very interesting character who became, I believe was born a man and then became a woman.
Yeah,
is that right. It? Yeah, and yep. And is a very prominent transhumanist. And you know, you should just take notice that when certain people are pushing something, be it transgender movement, the way people are pushing marijuana legalization now, which I'm obviously in favor of, but you have to really wonder when people like Gupta on CNN are yeah, this is great, yeah, we should all do it now. you know.
And again, they're pushing the shallow version of everything on us so that we just blindly accept everything. And the entire transhumanist agenda rolls along step by step while we're never seeing the next thing. And that's the whole point, too. And somebody like Martine Rothblatt, I think this is my personal opinion, and I may be wrong in this, but I think the reason that she is now a woman is a different reason than most transgender people probably are. It may be one and the same, and again, I might be totally off base with this, but I believe that Martine Rothblatt is somebody. Well, I know that Martine Rothblatt is somebody who understands the occult. That, for one, we understand that. That leads me to believe that, just through quite a few things I've seen from her, that I think that her going from man to woman is more of a sort of ritualistic, alchemical thing for her. So it's about coming into godhood in the physical realm again, sort of encapsulating both genders in a physical way, mind you, again, like the transhumanist movement tends toward. I think that's what that's about. I've mentioned this before. I, I don't know if anybody's going to believe me. I don't really care. I think this is just my opinion on the matter. I know it's out there, and this whole conversation's out there, so I'm enjoying it.
Oh yeah, well that's that, I mean that was you make a big point about saying that in the book, that if you are really a true seeker of the truth and of knowledge and of, you know, understanding the world around you, then you have to be willing to kind of go out there. And that's why I love your show as well, because you really are willing to go out on a limb, and you really make people think a lot. There's one other aspect that we really can't skip over here in terms of alchemical sciences and transhumanism, and that is the whole death rebirth ritual that we can see being played out. You know, in terms of alchemy, this didn't necessarily have to mean the actual death of someone. Yeah. But as we see in transhumanism, like you say, taking it to a very material, very real, tangible way, they truly are talking about the destruction of humanity, and from that, rebuilding this post-human society. So perhaps we could talk a little bit about the alchemical meanings behind the death rebirth ritual first, and then go into transhumanism.
Okay, yes. Okay, so again, we're talking about a sort of allegorical, philosophical story within alchemy that's played out through symbol, through story, and it's meant to invoke a change in the human observer, the human thinker, the philosopher. Okay, so alchemy is all for the philosophers, you know, you got the philosopher's stone. It's all about how does one turn the base metals into gold. The base metals is, again, just a metaphor for the base human existence, the human personality, the human body to an extent too, because it's about the physical. But it's how do you get a change from the negative to the positive, basically. And it's all about a change in attitude, really. So I think about this sometimes in that alchemy is the original self-help. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Before there was self-help, there was alchemy.
Yeah.
and always throughout time with the secret societies, it's been the people who have been able to see the world differently and be able to understand that they do have the power to change themselves that have been kind of singled out for initiation in the secret societies. So so that's really the background, is the people who have the ability to see things just from a different light. That's the secret society thing. And alchemy is about, you know, just making a change. And it's really not really any more complicated than that. It gets very obtuse, but that's the simple way of explaining it.
Well, it's very easy to get bogged down in the whole idea of turning lead into gold, and people take it so literally.
Yes.
To the point when, you know, if I bring this up in casual conversation, people, you know, look at you like you have two heads, you know.
Why are you
alchemy, that's stupid. That's, you know, that's, you know, something you learn about in school is sort of, oh, isn't this funny? People really believe this. Whereas in reality, you know, we are the lead, and gold is the new man, the enlightened one. Yeah. And you talk a lot about the idea of, you know, the Iron Age, the Bronze Age. You know, these are different ages that we lived in, and we represent the iron and the bronze. And perhaps we're now reaching a golden age where this will all sort of come to fruition.
Yeah, people use that terminology. Yeah, and history takes on an alchemical quality. So we're living alchemical history, and we don't even know it.
Especially the way that alchemy has just sort of infiltrated into every bit of our life without people really understanding it. But of course, I mean, a secret society would, you know, that's how they get off.
That's all part of their method. Yeah, and that's actually what makes it work better too. That it takes some thought to understand what that means, but it really is true when you think about it.
And getting back to the death rebirth ritual, obviously this is very prevalent in alchemical sciences, but transhumanists openly talk about the idea that millions upon millions of people would eventually would die or would have to die so that we could rebuild from this, which is a very disturbing notion, which, yeah. I think that by and large, this is really being put out there by the sort of upper transhumanist people and groups or whatnot, and that the average person who believes that, you know, life extension and cloning is a good thing wouldn't really be on board with this.
Yeah.
But it is a very disturbing reality that they openly talk about. And, from this, they would be able to create the post-human, I guess. And then from that, you would then have the transhumanists. There's always, a little stage before that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a process like alchemy. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. And, do you think, in your opinion, that the transhumanists, obviously there are some that are aware of alchemy, but how do you think that really fits in with the average transhumanist, or even the sort of people like the Kurzweils and things like that? How aware of this are they?
It's definitely a case-by-case basis. As we were saying, there's some people who absolutely know the occult side of all of this, and they have their own goals within that alchemical sphere. And I think if we're talking about dark and subversive version of alchemy, of which I certainly believe there is, and I think that's the real issue here with the transhumanist thing. If you're talking about the dark alchemists, I think they're the ones who knowingly have an occult agenda. They just sort of subversively use their occult symbolism on people who they're trying to get in tune with the idea, again, because it's all about the idea of transhumanism and getting that, selling that. That's the number one thing they have to do. Selling that without people understanding, all the while for them themselves, they're seeking out this literal eternal life, this literal joining of male and female within themselves to become gods. And I think that it's an incredibly materialistic view of the world with which they are. It's very funny because they're giving an incredibly materialistic view to their followers, but it's not an occult materialistic view. It's a completely profane, shallow, materialistic view of the world. And lo and behold, everybody's confused down here in the kiddie pool where we all exist. Nobody knows what's going on. Mm. However, people who
Aaron?
That we should do are going, hey, look, this is great, this is wonderful, but they never have the full picture. And even somebody, you're saying Ray Kurzweil, I wonder about him.
I can only speculate
with him.
I kind of view him more and more now as sort of a puppet, that I'm sure he's initiated to some degree about what the agenda is, but he seems like a very easy person to put out there, and that they can be sort of the public face of this.
I think you're exactly right. Fool's Mountain.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And, you talk a lot about the military aspects of this and all these, Pentagon white papers and the UK Defense Department. Those are really the people that are actually shaping this. These are people who you don't know their name.
On that note, Kurzweil has bragged at points that he has been an advisor to the U.S. military. and you'll find that prominent transhumanists have similar stories. I think it's Bostrom. Nick Bostrom has consulted with the CIA. Natasha Vita Moore, similar. I forget what affiliation she had. You've got Peter Thiel, the big money guy
behind
PayPal. I mean, obviously, he's got connections going on there with the intelligence crowd. A lot of the guys that are on the AI side, their projects have been big government contracts, and they work with like the biggest, the CDC and like similar things like that. And I think that there's a lot of affiliations going on with those transhumanists that they're unable to talk about.
Into that in the book about, I mean, how do we even really know how far this has gone? Because of course there's what they're going to tell us, and they're, I don't know if you watch anything about robotics and stuff, it's kind of the same stuff over and over again. It doesn't really seem to be going anywhere, but you have to wonder, is the Pentagon really going to let the Discovery Channel do an in-depth documentary about some sort of super robot soldier that they have? Probably not. So you have to wonder how far this is really going.
It's a step-by-step process. They take one little step, They gain acceptance as much as they can for the idea. They go as far as they can in that amount of time. Then they pull back, and then they come out with something else that takes it a little further. And it's a slow, gradual process, again, akin to the Fabian sort of technique. But it's a slow, ever-changing thing, but it's always got the same goal in mind. Yeah, definitely.
And then that's how it's able to sort of reach the level right now.
Oh.
Aaron?
That...
Oh, man.
That was me.
Oh, okay. Who knows? Kurzweil or something?
My Ferrari I got in the garage there. It's, my wife must be messing around with it.
Oh, okay. Well, no problem. I wasn't sure what that was. back to the transhumanist. How do you? I was having this discussion the other day with some friends of mine, and you know, I was saying that this slow progression is you know, it's happening, it's moving, and that this could be a reality. And many of my friends were saying, well, no way, because no one really wants to have, you know, chips implanted into their brain. Obviously, some people do, but most people aren't really in favor of a supercomputer AI system that would be linked, you know, through a hive mind to everyone on the planet, and we would all do these things. But at the same time, I think that there is a really strong push for this. So, you know, how do you see this really coming about? Because I think that a lot of people would just view this as complete fantasy. But in many ways, this is becoming so real that it could happen. So I was wondering sort of your take on that whole situation.
Well, we are on our way. And in terms of the idea, the realm of ideas, we're getting more and more entertainment depicting transhumanist situations and people who have brain chips, and they're the heroes. They're always the heroes. They're always doing things that other people can't. They're adored. They're loved. When you watch entertainment media like that, it makes you want to be like the hero, and it's a sales pitch for those sorts of technologies, of which we, the average person, most people don't realize that they are already have been developed, those sorts of technologies, but they have been. Again, the real problem is in selling the idea and not in actually developing it. And that's what nobody understands, is this, nobody puts enough emphasis on ideas, ideals, how powerful they are, how much our beliefs about the world shape the world. Again, this ties back to alchemy. But at a more practical level, our cellular telephones, our computers, and again, Ray Kurzweil is always saying like this. He's saying, look what your phone can do. It's more powerful than any computer was. And the computers in 1950 were huge rooms, and they could do only a fraction of what our phones can do now. We carry them around in our pockets. And, you know, we're connected so much now. And people actually make the argument that we're smarter now because we're able to
look
up anything on Google. And that's debatable, to say the least. But I would say that through this sort of activity, we are becoming transhumanized, or we're becoming more and more dependent, and we're having more and more of a intimate relationship with our technology, whether we realize it or not. And again, the number one issue I have in all this, and it deserves to be mentioned as much as possible, is that everybody takes everything for granted. Nobody understands what's going on now. Everybody thinks about the future all the time, and they see these, if they're not fantastical, again, they're idealized versions of the future in terms of technology and transhumanism. They're not seeing the process in action, and we're living it out, and nobody seems to be the wiser, and it's, I just don't know how. Well, now's the time that we should just take a moment, you know, take a breath. That's what I'm saying. Just stop, you know, you put the cellular phone down for a minute at least. Yeah, sit down, maybe preferably outdoors. Look at a tree for about 5 minutes. And then, you know, kind of think to yourself, like, what do I do on a daily basis? How do I spend my day? And what percentage of the day do I spend doing this and doing that? And what does that mean? And if you're honest with yourself, you'll find that you're spending a large portion of your time using some kind of computer or your phone or whatever, and you should think about what it actually means to be doing that.
Yeah, and I also see it as a very covert way, and also in just people have become so kind of apathetic that, you know, they're like, yeah, whatever. Of course I'm on Facebook all the time, and I have to Instagram every piece of food that I eat and things like that. And within that, it's very easy to then sort of, you know, sort of silently slip something in, and people don't even necessarily realize it until it's too late. But then suddenly, well, it's all there now, so that's it. You know, we're not going backwards. We're only going to go forwards. Yeah. So I see a lot of that happening, especially amongst people my age. It's just, I mean, it's just wild how detached everybody is. I mean, to the point where, you know, if one person takes out a cell phone, everyone takes out their cell phone. And then suddenly everyone's looking at pictures that they, you know, of Instagram. And, you know, we're all here in the same room, guys. We're all looking at pictures that we all took, you know, 20 minutes ago. So perhaps it's not really worth it anymore.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Nobody's just thinking about the obvious. The obvious eludes us, and I don't know. We're just taking everything for granted, and we take everything for granted, and it's I don't know. I don't know what to say other than that.
No, yeah. And in the last chapter of your book, when you really start to sum all this up, and you start to just say that, you know, we can counter this. This isn't, you know, there's a lot of fear porn and doom mongering out there. And, you know, obviously the alchemists and the transhumanists love this because they're always talking about the sort of end times and the death rebirth. So, of course, they want to, you know, really drill that into your psyche. But you can counter this, and it can be as simple as not taking out your cell phone every day, you know, leaving it at home. I mean, it's not going to be the end of the world. You know, there are little things like that. And I also, another part of the book that I really, really appreciated was that, you know, you don't shy away from spirituality and the mystery of spirituality and the beauty within it. And I found that to be really powerful because while the alchemists want to sort of explain every little bit of, you know, what is humanity, why are we here, there's something really wonderful in the mystery of that. And you don't really need to discover that, but you can still embrace it, and it can still be a very important part of your life. And at the same time, that's not to sort of be, you know, a Luddite and shun all technology. Obviously, you know, we're talking right now on Skype, so there's always there are many times there's a useful application for these things. But really, we just need to kind of turn off the computer, go outside, interact with people. You know, don't go on World of Warcraft or Second
Place. Yeah. Well, one of my big gripes with the status quo, how things are at the moment, is that everybody seems to need an absolute answer on everything. You know, it's either one way or it's the other. It's like, well, are the fundamentalist Christians correct in their ideas of the genesis of humanity, or are the Darwinian determinists correct in their estimation of things? And, you know, it has to either be one side or the other. You know, it couldn't be anything else, could it? Like, and meanwhile, everybody who is somewhere in between this debate, of which I would say the majority of people are, they get demoralized by just all this like asinine argument by extremists, and people are just like taking everything to extremes, and because they think in absolutes. There's no room for subtlety, and now more than ever we need to see the gray areas. We need to understand that so much of the human experience, it's not about what's objective. Sure, we can be objective. However, we have to understand that the human experience is all really. I would say that there's a premium. I would put a premium on the subjective experience, because each person makes their life what they want it to be, and the world is as they see it. And that means that there are an infinite amount of worlds within one world, because it's all different people seeing things a little bit differently. But that means a lot. And just the realization that that's true, I think, makes you genuinely tolerant of other people. You know what I mean? Like, where we get this, we're given this shallow version that's, again, taking us to absolutes. You absolutely have to be in favor of something. Otherwise, you are not progressive.
Right. And you're a bigot.
You're a bigot. You're either a bigot or you're progressive, and there's no room for nuance. There's no going, yes, okay, I see what you're saying, but what is the greater context of the argument we're putting forth here? You know, so we're all, again, we're in a shallow pool. And I don't think that we have to be, and I certainly don't think that we need technology to raise to this next level of human evolution to do so. In fact, I think if we did, if we tried to kickstart our intelligence from such out of whack, shallow, psychologically wrecked place that we are in, I mean, I don't think there's a doubt about it. There should not be a doubt about that for me, and that's how the world is. If we go forward at lightning speed from where we are, from this psychologically wrecked position, we're going to amplify that. You know what I mean? Mm. And that's the real problem, I think.
Mm. And there's also this sort of taboo about spirituality. You know, it's and that's obviously the atheist agenda in full swing here. And, you know, if you think about spirituality, well, then you're stupid, or or you're part of the New Age crowd.
Yep.
Which takes it to such an extreme that, they're just sort of so stuck in a little tiny box that they can never get out of. But it is important to embrace this and to seek out the spiritual side of things and not to just use technology to, also, I think it's you don't need to know the answers to everything. We live in this world where it's so, well, I'll just look it up online, who that guy was in that movie I saw once before, whatever. And people are just not willing to just sort of let life happen. They always want to sort of finish it. And to kind of sum that up too, in the book a lot, you talk about the whole idea of a revolution and revolving and the circle itself. And you talk a lot about how, these so-called revolutions, and that can be a revolution of the mind, it could be a real tangible political revolution, it essentially brings you back to the same place. You're not really going further. You're just, starting at point A, and then you go around and things do change, but then you come right back to point A again. And, we're really sort of stuck in that mindset that we need to free ourselves from.
Well, the occult tradition bases all of its work on the study of nature. And nature works in cycles. You've got, the seasons of the year. They all play out and they have their different effects on the entire world and on everything in it. However, they always come back to the same point. So it spins around a circle and it revolves, and that's the process of nature. Therefore, the process of alchemy has modeled that, and it is cyclical too. So it starts with something dead, and it brings it back to life, and then it dies again, only to rise once more to life. So it's all about time and matter and life and the interplay of all of that. And so many of the occult ideas here are imbued into historical revolutions, certainly. If you're talking about the occult connection to revolutionary movements, it's there in spades.
Revolution is a huge example of that, and the Illuminati's influence in funding them, and there's the famous George Washington quote where he talks about how the Illuminati has infiltrated into all of these things, and even just the concept of the way that revolution has sort of been, in the past, at least in the past 2 years, has been just pounded into the psyche of people, be it the Egyptian revolution or Anonymous talking about revolution and all of that kind of stuff. And, you can look at that and you can pretend to yourself that something has really changed, but essentially all of the same power structures are in place. Now the names might change, but Egypt is still ruled by the military. So nothing has changed whatsoever. But yet, you see all of these, movies coming out about revolution and all these wonderful things. And I think there is something to be said that revolution doesn't really bring about anything real or anything positive to that. Yeah. It's really about the revolution of yourself, of your own mind, and changing, and growing that way, and not really about some sort of political movement that, of course, is always directed by a handful of people at the very top.
Yep. And your podcast does a great job of just showing us the simple fact of the matter with these Egyptian revolutions and all that. And that is a very valuable thing that most people just don't do. But again, it feeds into this greater understanding because you can see things as they are. It's like, okay, we have a revolution. And if I were to be sort of naive and just take the storybook version that I'm given of this story, be like, oh, the people are free now. Democracy is good. I feel good. I'm going to go eat a chicken sandwich for dinner. that's what's expected of us. Mm. So see, we're treated like children, and it's that to me is, if you're talking about like the occult aspect of that, that's a whole nother story, but that's just, it's very demeaning to the public at large. I think that we're all smarter than this. Mm-hmm. We should realize that there are people who take advantage of and agitate any kind of revolutionary movement for their own greater gain, because they're already in a position of control where they've maneuvered themselves to be able to take advantage of little guys. You know what I mean? That's just the structure of things. That's just how things work. Violent revolutionaries are nobodies who aren't seeing the greater picture, and that makes them perfect to be manipulated. If we as a whole, as observers, are not privy to that, then the whole process will enamor us and we'll be caught up in it too. And then we'll be believing, and therefore, because the subjective is our reality, since we believe it to be true, it is true. And again, here's all the people who want an objective version of reality. Well, you're living a lie, and it's a subjective lie. Big surprise. I'm sorry to break it to you.
Right.
Your view of the world is incorrect. You can criticize me in that mine is incorrect, and you know it may be in many ways, but I'm able to admit that I'm seeing things from my own lens, and there's real significance in that.
And then, I mean, of course, it's also, it all comes back to, well, you know, the revolution is all about, well, democracy and government. Yeah. And we just, you know, if we just change that, then it'll all come into place, as if that is somehow the answer to all of life's woes.
Yeah, certainly not.
Well, Aaron, thank you so much. This was an excellent conversation. I really had a fun time. Briefly, can you tell everybody where they can purchase Revolve, Man's Scientific Rise to Godhood, and about your podcast and your website? And please tell the listeners about your new podcast that you're doing with Adam from Cerebral Revolt.
Yeah, sure. Well, the website is ageoftransitions.com. Just type that in, ageoftransitions.com, and you'll find everything. That's my website with videos, articles. I have a lot on the site. I do my podcast, Trans Resistor Radio. I hope you'll subscribe to it, listen to it, check out the archive, save all the episodes for later, listen to them later, you know. And the new podcast that you mentioned, I'm doing with Adam of CerebralRevolt.com. He's a good friend of mine. We've decided to do a podcast about movies. We're reviewing movies for now, and we're picking apart agendas in movies, because there are agendas in movies. Like I'm saying, ideas have power. So ideas are being put out through films with agendas attached. And we're just trying to, you know, pick that apart. And so we do one of those a month. That's on the Trans Resistor Radio feed. So just, you know, subscribe to Trans Resistor Radio. You'll be able to listen to that. I have a YouTube channel you can subscribe to. And the book, Revolve, Man's Scientific Rise to God, it is on my website, ageoftransitions.com. You can buy the paperback. I hope that you will buy the paperback. You get a DVD copy of Age of Transitions film when you get it, and you get some stickers. And I just, you know, I just like the paperback. I'm proud of it.
The pictures are fantastic. It looks beautiful. I would definitely go with the paperback.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you said that, because I am proud of this book. I think it came out really good in a lot of ways. I'm currently writing a new book. It's in its infancy stage, so I don't want to talk too much about that. But back to Revolve, you can get a Kindle version for the ebook. And that's it. ageoftransitions.com, and I'm Aaron Franz.
Well, thank you so much, Aaron. And I would urge all my listeners to go out and get a copy of this book, because it will truly just, if you really want to become illuminated and to really have a better understanding of the world that you live around you, Revolve, Man's Scientific Rise to Godhood is an excellent place to start. Well, thank you so much, Aaron.
Thank you, Pierce. Yes.
Okay, everybody, so that was our conversation with Aaron Franz from theageoftransitions.com. My name is Pierce Redman, and you've been listening to Porkins Policy Radio. You can find this podcast and a whole lot more by going to porkinspolicyreview.wordpress.com. You can follow us through the RSS feed, through email. You can follow us on Twitter, at Porkins Policy. And you can also subscribe to my YouTube channel, which is youtube.com/1138Porkins. And if you do like the material that I'm putting out there, then please help me spread the word. Tell your friends, put it on social media, do whatever you got to do. It helps me a lot, and it's really greatly appreciated. Well, I'll talk to you very soon.